We are going to join our conversation with Nathan from Georgia. He's a 14-year-old guy, listens to Real Science Radio. He's got great questions about evolution and creation. We began this last week. So if you haven't heard part one, just go to our website, rsr.org. Just scroll down the recent shows and you'll see the one titled Real Science Radio talks to Nathan from Georgia. Now let's join this conversation in progress. So for one thing, we got to recognize that while there is a pattern in the deposition of animals and plants in the geologic column, there are significant exceptions. But what we think we see is not the order of development of the tree of life, but rather the order that creatures were buried during the global flood. So right. That you had all the animals that were created on day five, day six, plants on day three. So they're all alive together from the first week of creation. But they didn't necessarily all live in the same places on the earth. So the things that would get buried first are in the lowlands, like in the bottoms of lakes and seas, worms and trilobites and creatures like that. So they get buried first. And as sediments from the flood are rushing in to fill up these lakes and seas, then you have fish that are buried. And then you have rodents that are buried. And eventually you have creatures that live in different habitats or at higher elevations or are better able to escape the floodwaters. And so they tend to be found higher in the geologic column. But as you probably know, Nathan, we have made a prediction on Real Science Radio that biological material in fossils, in other words, still soft, so it's not yet decomposed. There are actual proteins, red blood cells, blood vessels, parts of DNA. You will find original biological material all throughout the geologic column from the Precambrian to the Cambrian, the Jurassic, you know, all the way up. And that's exactly what has been discovered and published in the world's leading science journals. And of course, dinosaur soft tissue. There's been about 20 different papers, 24 papers published on dinosaur soft tissue. So a lot of evidence that the geologic column is a record of the deposition of the flood and not a record of any kind of Darwinian evolution. So why do we find Archaeopteryx fossils where we do and not elsewhere? I'm not sure. It could be because of the habitat that they lived in. It could be that mammals and reptiles like dinosaurs lived in different habitats at different elevations, and the destructive forces of the flood at the in the habitats and the elevations where they lived might have buried them at an earlier stage, as in, you know, days earlier than it did other mammals and birds. Although we have on our website now over 430 mammal species have been identified, excavated in the dinosaur layers. So when we call it the age of reptiles, that's a little bit deceptive, and the museums refuse to put mammals in with their dinosaur exhibits, but that's very deceptive because there were loads of mammals all over the world. In fact, we've excavated a mammal with a dinosaur in its stomach. Mammals ate dinosaurs.
Right. I really like the conversation because it's really getting me to think. I know this bird in South America called the Hotsin, and, you know, it has claws on its wings.
Oh,
and,
right.
You know, it's still found today, and it's actually during juvenile stages that it has claws on its wings. But I did a little bit of research on it, and, again, it's very similar to the Archaeopteryx. And the Archaeopteryx was found fossil layer-wise, it was found much lower than the Hotsin. So, to me, it's just interesting.
Nathan, the fact that these two species have claws, that's like a mosaic, right? Where you have an animal that has features of other animals that it's not close to when you do taxonomy, classification. So the most famous case probably of a mosaic is the duck-billed platypus. You familiar with that animal?
Oh, very familiar.
It has a duck-like beak and feet and lays eggs like a bird, but it has fur and mammary glands like a mammal. And you and I talked about echolocation in whales and bats. The duck-billed platypus has echolocation.
Oh, wow.
It has sonar, and it has poison glands like a frog. So what in the world did it evolve from, right?
That's a great question.
Yeah, so the platypus is an example, like Archaeopteryx, that shows you that the claim that similar features show that one creature evolved into another is absurd. A whale mm-hmm. didn't evolve into a bat. An elephant didn't evolve into an elephant shrew.
Yep, and I agree with 100% with that. But again, like I've been doing some research on the whole platypus thing you're talking about earlier, and you know, like the fact that it has a bill like a duck to me is just interesting. I mean, there's like, I guess all the features, like once you look at all the features and all and combine them all together, I mean, it has reptilian features even, and I'm just like, hold on a second, how did this all come together at once? And, where it even has the ability to lay eggs. I'm like, wow.
And this is how crazy the Darwinists have become. If you have chicken for dinner, they say you're eating a dinosaur. They believe that a chicken is a dinosaur. They think that mammals are reptiles. They think that if a chicken is a dinosaur and dinosaurs were reptiles, they argue that chickens are reptiles. In fact, they say that birds are reptiles. And it really, everything is everything. And it's interesting that atheism eventually leads to complete and utter ignorance.
I know. And, you know, like with the whole dinosaur thing and like calling birds dinosaurs, maybe they're just too chicken to make up a new idea.
So, Nathan, when we're talking about features that appear in different kind of creatures, we have a page at Real Science Radio, rsr.org/fingerprints. And we talk about the fact that fingerprints are only on humans in a couple species. Do you know which creatures have fingerprints?
Okay, so first thing we see is apes, then we see monkeys, and then humans have fingerprints. But we also see koalas, oddly
yeah,
enough.
Yeah, right, right.
Four different fingerprints.
Okay, so let's think about that for a moment from a Darwinian perspective and from a creation perspective. Fingerprints are an identification system, and they're an information management system. You get your fingerprints developed in the womb, in the fetal stage, and they stay with you your whole life long, and no two people have the same fingerprints. If you burn your hands so that your fingerprints burn off, or you cut your fingers so that they're severely damaged, if the skin grows back, the fingerprints re-express themselves. You have your same fingerprints. That's an astounding information database. You need an information management system to keep those fingerprints the same and yet different for every person who's ever been born, as far as we know.
When I was younger, I cut my thumb with a knife on accident, and it only took 2 weeks, but like my fingerprints retraced themselves where like the cut was. So I think it's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's astounding. God is so brilliant. So,
what
survival advantage, and we're not talking about just a rough texture and friction on your digits. We're not talking about that, because it could be like sandpaper and it could change throughout your life and they don't all have to be different. It could just be texture and rough. But what survival advantage would it give a koala bear to have distinguishable fingerprints that remain the same throughout its whole life long?
None that I know of, unless it's some reason for climbing trees, but I don't think that would really logically add up.
No, it couldn't be, right? The fact that you have friction, you wouldn't like perfectly smooth fingertips because you wouldn't have as much friction. But you wouldn't need an information management system that gave you unique and lifelong patterns. You wouldn't need that. And everything has a cost, right? In nutrition and energy, it takes energy to run every system in a biological organism. And fingerprints are no different. So it takes space on your DNA, and it takes the proteins, and it takes the regulatory genes to make that all happen. And if it conferred no survival advantage, first of all, it would not evolve. And second of all, if it had evolved, it wouldn't remain. You'd lose it. That's according to Darwinism. So fingerprints are awesome evidence for the Creator God. And they come in most handy as an ability to identify human beings throughout our entire lives, including, for example, for criminal justice and for other purposes. You have a baby, you know, you take his footprints and his fingerprints and you make sure you don't mix up the kids. Well, then why would God put fingerprints on apes? Why would he do that? Do you have any thoughts?
The only reason I could ever think of would be for climbing advantages, but I still don't know if like they actually serve any purpose for climbing or not.
Well, remember the difference. We're not just talking about friction, because if you just didn't want smooth fingertips, that doesn't mean you need an identification system that remains the same your entire life. There's a lot of effort that would go into maintaining that information.
Koalas don't have that kind of fingerprint feature, if I'm not mistaken. I think it's only, again, like koalas, humans, monkeys, and apes.
So when God created, let's try to answer the question, why would God put fingerprints on these other creatures? When God created, 6 days he finished, seventh day he rested, do you think he enjoyed what he accomplished?
I think so.
Yeah. I think, well, let me ask you this. Do you think he impressed himself?
Yes, much of it, like, especially like all the huge creatures of the earth. Like,
yeah.
Look at the whales and all.
Yeah. When you read the last chapters of the book of Job, God goes on and on about he created these different creatures, and he totally loved it. And it was so cool, and it was so amazing. And at the end of the 6 days, every day, not on the second day, but every other day, he said, it was good, it was good, it was good. It was very good by the end of the sixth day. So there are many Christians, and I know that they're trying to glorify God and magnify him. And they say the Bible says that God created in 6 days, but he could have created in 6 seconds or in the blink of an eye. I realize they're trying to magnify him, but accidentally what they might be doing is diminishing his accomplishment. He very well astounded himself by what he had done. And so when we get to see the Lord in heaven, we could ask him about these things. But there's every reason to believe that God enjoyed the act of creating like any creator would, a musician or a sculptor or an author or an engineer, an architect. You enjoy the act of designing, and then you enjoy the implementation of your design. So when God came up with the fingerprint system that he wanted to use on human beings, then he would implement that twice, once with Adam and again with Eve. And after that, it would be in our biological reproduction. But he may have wanted to do it more because it was enjoyable. It's a system he designed. And he liked the act of creating, so he wanted to put it in a few other creatures just so he could enjoy doing it. And that's very possibly why he gave sonar to a duck-billed platypus, because it was really cool to do that.
That's true. I wonder, though, could evolutionists use the fingerprints to claim that we came from apes because apes climb in trees?
Okay, what is my response to the evolutionist who would say fingerprints help you climb in trees? If they were going to argue that you needed some texture on your fingertips, that's fine. All creatures probably have texture on their digits. But fingerprints are an unchanging, lifelong identification system. And a lot of effort and resources go into maintaining that specific design on your fingertips throughout your whole life. A chimpanzee could climb as long as his fingers were textured and not totally smooth. He doesn't need fingerprints that retain the same design throughout his whole life. And so a chimpanzee wouldn't have to develop such a system of information management to continue to persist with the same design on their fingertips. All they needed was friction. That's it.
Yep.
Just bumps. Like teeth. Teeth have bumps on them so that you can grind grain and corn. But teeth, they don't have fingerprints on them, and the texture doesn't stay the same your whole life. It changes literally every day.
Mm-hmm.
So fingerprints are different. They're an identification system.
Yes.
And it's that aspect of fingerprints that are not needed for survival in the wild.
Mm.
It's not the texture. It's not the texture.
Okay. Yes. Why are, like with camels, how they develop the ability to have water sort of on their back? Is that evolution right there?
Mm.
Because, you know, like when you look at a llama, they don't really, I don't think they have that ability.
Yeah, right. Dromedaries, you got one hump camels, two hump camels, llamas. And camels and llamas can reproduce, right? They call it a comma.
Yep.
And we realize that in every organism, maybe not every, but it seems like every organism, it's hard to say every because there are over a million species that have been identified, that God has put incredible genetic diversity in creatures where they express themselves over time and as a response to an environment. So how much genetic diversity can there be? Like, I know that they've taken plants that lived on islands, and we've known them for centuries, and it's like a bush. It's a bush. You take it off the island, you plant it on the mainland, and now it's a tree with a trunk.
Yes.
It's like, how in the world did that happen? Well, the genetic information in the DNA of that bush had also the ability to express itself as a tree with a trunk.
Mm.
And so the evolutionist would say, well, it's going to take thousands of generations to go from one to the other. But it turns out both of these phenotypes, they're both in the genotype. Both of the body plans are in the genome, and it expresses itself given the opportunity. There are even some creationists who don't really like the term natural selection because it seems to take the credit away from the creator and away from the organism and its genome, and it gives the credit to like the dark cave or the heated water or the mucky pond, you know? But it's the organism that is responding based on what kind of genetic variability God originally put into that kind. When he made camels, how many camels do you think God made on the earth?
I want to say, well, when he made the original kinds, well, then two.
Okay.
He made two camels or llamas, whatever the original
All right.
kinds were.
Now, here, you just did something, I think, unintentional, Nathan.
Mm-hmm.
You combined two things, Noah's Ark with the creation of Adam and Eve.
Mm-hmm.
See, when God made Adam and then Eve, he made only two, right? Human beings. Mm-hmm. When Noah brought animals on the ark, he brought seven of the clean animals and a single pair of the unclean animals. But when God made dolphins, there's no reason to think he made two. The world was filled with life. The seas were undoubtedly teeming with life at the end of day six. So God may have made something like 20 million dolphins. We don't know. And he may have made 50,000 camels. We don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the question of how much genetic diversity did God put into these creatures? But then there was a genetic bottleneck at the global flood.
Right.
Depending on whether the creatures were clean or unclean. And that differentiation was only for whether they were acceptable as sacrifice or not. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think came first, the camel or the llama?
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I do not know.
Well, that's
fine. Yeah. And it could be that there were both.
Mm-hmm.
It could be that there were both. I don't know. I do know that there's a tremendous effort underway by creationists. And in fact, even the atheist evolutionists who hate us, like Eugenie Scott, she has a group, the National Center for Science Education. I debated Eugenie Scott years ago. We still sell that debate. She said the best evolution was junk DNA. And I challenged her on that. That was in the 90s. And today the journal Nature has published, although they used to say 95% or more of our DNA was junk, now they've confirmed that 80% is functional, and they think it's going up closer to 100%.
Oh, wow.
So who won the debate, the PhD atheist evolutionist or the Bible-thumping talk show host? So that field is called baraminology, the study of what were the original created kinds. And Eugenie Scott's group, NCSE, they have an article on the creationist effort at baraminology, and they've actually said that it's a very well-disciplined, careful study to try to determine what the original kinds were. So even though they disagree with the whole thing, they've admitted to the scholarship and the effort. So we don't know yet, or I don't know, there may be creationists who have figured out the answer to that question. I think we have time for one last topic. So what do you want to discuss?
Okay, sounds good. So I want to discuss apes and monkeys having color vision, same type of color vision as humans do, like actually being able to see multi-different colors and not just like different like colors in the sense that it's like one color and two colors. It's like multi-colors.
Yeah, so what do we call creatures that can only see black and white? We call it, we have trichromatic vision, trichromatic, right? We see red, green, and blue. We have these photoreceptors. And so we're able to, with those three colors, we could distinguish literally millions of colors, just like we could distinguish millions of scents through our olfactory abilities. So creatures that can only see black and white, we call them monochromatic. And then there's dichromatic and trichromatic like we have, full color range. Now, Darwinism says you could only take small steps at a time, right?
Yep.
Charles Darwin and so many famous evolutionists have said if there was something that needed a big leap, then Darwinism would be proved false. Everything has to be accomplished in small steps, from Richard Dawkins to Theodosius Dobzhansky and on and on. So think about vision. And you asked about apes having color vision. You know, so do squirrels. Birds have great color vision. Insects, a lot of fish can see in color. So, and then some creatures like cats and dogs, no, not really. Not so much color vision. So think about going from a black and white TV to a color TV.
That is a huge leap to go from black and white vision to color vision.
Yes. Incredibly sophisticated. Not only in the photoreceptor cells, the rods and the cones, and the cones able to detect short, medium, and long wavelengths, but then you have to encode that information and send it over the optic nerve to your visual cortex, where it has to be decoded so that inside an insect's brain, when he sees a flower, the insect is not seeing a flower. There's not a projector inside its brain projecting an image of a flower. If you were to try to see it visually, it looks more like noise on a TV screen. All static. It's an electrochemical signal. It would be like, and a lot of people can't understand this analogy, Nathan. Maybe you can. I don't know. I don't like putting you on the spot.
That's fine.
But imagine your internet going to a computer display and you see an image from YouTube.
Right.
And if you were to cut the cable and try to look at the electrons and figure out what the image was going to be, well, that'd be absurd, right? You couldn't do it.
Yes.
Because there is a very specific encoding and decoding that is extremely sophisticated. Another way you could possibly encode an image is to put it in a stream of water. Like put your hand beneath your kitchen faucet and turn on the water. And if we had good enough technology, we could probably encode a JPEG, an image, in that water flow, probably as it's hitting your hand. But but do you realize how difficult it would be to sense the image that's hitting your hand? It would be wildly crazy to try to accomplish that.
Oh, yeah.
Now imagine, and that image, whatever inputs, whatever chemical, electrical inputs are coming into your brain, that's the encoding of the image, it's changing probably thousands of times per second. Mm-hmm. And you have to encode and decode these packets of information and assemble them all together to get an image just like your cell phone has to do or your TV. So the evolutionist, when they describe an insect developing a vision system, they skip all of that. They skip all that complexity like it doesn't exist.
It's crazy. It's absurd.
Yes. And you, I see that you recognized immediately going from monochromatic to dichromatic to trichromatic. Each of those are incredibly complex steps that involve serious physics and integration of information and an expansion of a pre-existing system. There is no intermediary step between monochromatic and dichromatic. There's nothing in between. It's an enormous technological leap, and there's no intermediary step between dichromatic. Like we used to have monitors, they were amber. You know, it was either white or amber. And to go from that to a full color monitor, these are giant leaps of technology. And so just that falsifies Darwinism.
Right. That those are designed.
Yes.
When we look at it that way, then how crazy would it be? I mean, I think it takes more faith to believe in evolution in that case than to believe in creation. In fact, in really any case, and especially that one, it takes a lot of faith to believe in evolution.
I love how you put it like that. So if the evolutionist will say to some gullible kid in school, well, look, monkeys have color vision and so do we, so we evolved from monkeys or apes. Well, if the kid was more well-educated, he'd say, yeah, but insects have color vision too. Did we evolve from insects? And how about birds and squirrels and fish? So they have this very biased selection of data that they choose to use to sell their story, and it's very deceptive. If you look at our website, Nathan, rsr.org/I, EYE for vision, I got to debate a University of California professor of ophthalmology. And he said to me, well, before we debate, you have to read my associate's textbook. He just got published, The Evolution of the Eye. And so college book textbooks are expensive. Cost me like $100. So I get the book. And I made a prediction. We had witnesses sign the prediction. And it said this, that this book, hundreds of pages long, it will have almost nothing about how the eye evolved. Instead, it will be an anatomy book focusing on eyes. That's it. Just an anatomy book explaining how different eyes and different organisms function. And it turns out that's the whole book.
Crazy. That just sounds crazy. Like, he didn't even give you any examples.
Well, what I was looking for is, say, a chapter on the evolution of opsin, the protein in the photoreceptor that responds to the photon. Have you ever heard an evolutionist say that we have a poorly designed eye, human beings?
I have. Richard Dawkins, in fact.
Yeah, exactly. Because he says that our optical nerve comes out the front instead of the back. And he says how stupid it is. But an octopus has the optical nerve coming out the back and not the front. And that's because it lives in a marine environment, so it doesn't momentarily glance at the sun where we live on the surface. Have you ever had your photo taken with a flash camera? It sort of makes you go blind for a second or so. And that's because you need to regenerate these photoreceptors. And to do that, you need a tremendous supply of blood. So that's why the blood vessels are on what Richard Dawkins thinks is the wrong side of the retina.
Mm-hmm.
And so if an octopus lived up on the surface, or if we had an eye like an octopus, and you're running away from an enemy, and you glance at the sun, and then you go blind for 3 minutes while your photoreceptors are trying to get enough blood to regenerate, and then you're dead. So it wouldn't
disadvantage.
Yeah. So we have two eyes, and the blind spot we have in each eye, people live their whole lives, they don't even notice it. In fact, we are able to see a single photon. So they say we have a bad design, we have a fabulous design. So, Nathan, it's such a joy to talk through these issues with you. I hope we sufficiently answered your questions to give you direction for further research.
Oh, yes. Thank you for helping me with all of this. Like all these things I've learned in school and the textbooks, I hear other people say were really confusing me. But that really did clear it up, like how you explained all that. And specifically speaking, like how you're talking, and you went into detail about it. Like, I don't really hear a lot of creationists go into detail about it. So it really did help. Thank you.
Well, what a joy. Thank you, Nathan, for tuning in. It's an honor. And so hopefully we'll talk again sometime.
Yes, thank you. God bless.
Okay, God bless you. What a wonderful time to talk to such a young guy, 14-year-old Nathan from Georgia, one of our Real Science Radio listeners. So this is Bob Enyart for Fred Williams and Real Science Radio. May God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.